Jaiwardena paused outside Tachyon's door. He'd been sleeping when the alien called. Tachyon had apologized for taking so long to get back to him and began listing the reasons. Jaiwardena had interrupted and asked if he could come over immediately. The doctor had said yes with little enthusiasm. He knocked and waited, then raised his hand again before he heard footfalls from the other side. Tachyon opened the door, wearing a puffy-sleeved white shirt and blue velvet pants sashed with a large red scarf.
Mr. Jaiwardena?
Please, come in. Jaiwardena bowed and went in. Tachyon sat down on the bed underneath an oil painting of Dunhinda Falls. A scarlet-plumed hat and a partially eaten plate of rice were on the bedside table.
You are the same Mr. Jaiwardena from the helicopter? The one Radha told me about?
Yes. Jaiwardena lowered himself into the lounger next to the bed. I hope Mr. Braun wasn't injured.
Only his already bettered pride.
Tachyon closed his eyes for a moment as if trying to gather strength, then reopened them.
Please, tell me how I can help you, Mr. Jaiwardena.
The military is planning on attacking the ape tomorrow. We must stop them and subdue the creature ourselves.
Jaiwardena rubbed his eyes.
But I'm not starting at the beginning. The military deals with harsh reality. But you, Doctor, work in the context of the extraordinary on a daily basis. I don't know you, but I am in a position of needing to trust you.
Tachyon placed his dangling feet firmly on the floor and straightened his shoulders.
I've spent most of my life here trying to live up to the trust of others. I only wish I could believe the trust was warranted. But you say we must stop the military and subdue the ape ourselves.
Why? Surely they're better equipped, Jaiwardena interrupted.
The virus doesn't affect animals, if I understand correctly.
I know the virus doesn't affect animals, Tachyon replied with a shake of his curly red hair. I helped develop the virus. Every child knows.
He covered his mouth. Ancestors, forgive me.
He slid off the bed and walked to the window.
For 20 years it's been staring me in the face, and I missed it. By my own blind stupidity, I've sentenced some individual to a living hell. I've failed one of mine again. The trust isn't warranted.
Tachyon pressed his fists against his temples and continued berating himself.
Your pardon, Doctor, Jaiwardena said. I think your energies would be more beneficial if we applied them to the problem at hand.
Tachyon turned, a pained expression on his face. I meant no offense, Doctor, he added, sensing the depth of the alien's guilt.
No, of course not.
Mr. Jaiwardena, how did you know?
Not many of our people have been touched by the virus.
I am one of the very few.
I suppose I should be grateful to be alive and whole, but it's in our nature to complain.
My ability gives me visions of the future, always about someone or someplace I know, usually myself, and so detailed and vivid, he shook his head. My most recent one showed me the ape's true nature.
Tachyon sat back down on the bed, tapping his fingertips together.
What I don't understand is the primitive behavior exhibited by the creature.
I'm sure that most of our questions can be answered once he's a man again.
Of course, of course.
Tachyon popped up off the bed again.
And your ability, temporal displacement of the cognitive self during dream state. This was what my family had in mind when they created the virus. Something that transcends known physical values. Amazing.
Jaiwardena shrugged. Yes, amazing, but it's a burden I would gladly give up.
I want to view the future from its proper perspective. The here and now. This power destroys the natural flow of life.
After the ape is restored, I plan to make my pilgrimage to Sripada. Perhaps through spiritual purity I may be rid of it.
I've had some success reversing the effects at my clinic,
Tachyon twisted his sash.
Of course, the success rate isn't what I'd hoped, and the risk would be yours to take.
We must deal with the ape first. After that, my path may become more clear.
If only we had more time here,
Tachyon complained.
The tour is supposed to leave for Thailand day after tomorrow. That leaves us little margin for error, and we can't all go chasing out after the creature.
I don't think the government would allow it in any case, not after today. The fewer of your people we involve, the better.
Agreed. I can't believe the others went off like that. Sometimes I think we're all suffering from some kind of creeping insanity. Hiram, especially.
Tachyon walked to the window and opened the mini blinds. Lightning flashed on the horizon, briefly silhouetting the wall of towering thunderclouds.
Obviously, I must be included in this little adventure. Radha can give me maneuverability.
She's half Indian. There have been problems between your country and India lately, I believe.
Sadly, yes. The Indians support the Tamils, since they have the same cultural heritage. The Sinhalese majority looks at this as support for the Tamil Tigers, a terrorist group.
Jayawardena looked down at the floor. It is a conflict with no winners and too many victims.
So we must have a cover story, that Radha was hiding out afraid for her life. She might present the answer to some other problems.
Tachyon closed the blinds.
What weaponry will be used against the ape?
Two waves of helicopters. The first will move in with steel nets. The second, if needed, will be fully armed attack ships.
Could you slip us into their base before the second wave gets off the ground?
Tachyon rubbed his palms together.
Possibly. Yes, I think I could.
Good, the alien smiled. And Mr. Jayawardena, in my own defense, there's been so much in my life. The founding of the clinic, unrest in Joker Town, the swarm invasion.
Jayawardena cut him off. Doctor, you owe me no explanation.
But I will owe him one.
They'd stopped the car a couple of miles from the gate to put Radha into the trunk. Jayawardena took a sip of tea from his styrofoam cup. It was thick, coppery, and hot enough to help ward off the pre-dawn chill. Since the road to the airbase was so bumpy, he had only partially filled his cup. There was a cold ache inside him that even the tea could not reach. Even in his best-case scenario, he would be forced to resign his post. He was overstepping his authority in an unforgivable manner. But he couldn't worry about what might happen to him. The ape was his first concern. He and Tachyon had stayed up most of the night, trying to cover all the things that might go wrong and what to do if the worst happened. Jayawardena was in the front seat with Saul. Tachyon was in the back between Danforth and Paula. No one spoke. Jayawardena reached for his government ID as they approached the well-lit front gate. The gate guard was a young Sinhalese. His shoulders were as straight as the creases in his khaki uniform. His eyes were bright and he moved with measured steps to Jayawardena's side of the car. Jayawardena rolled down his window and handed the guard his ID.
"We wish to speak with General Dissanayake. Dr. Tachyon and two representatives of the American Film Company are in our party, as well as myself."
The guard looked at the ID, then at the people in the car. "One moment," he said, then headed over to the small booth beside the gate and picked up the phone. After speaking for a few moments, he walked back and handed the ID back with five laminated visitor badges.
"The general will see you. He's in his office. Do you know the way, sir?"
"Yes, thank you,"
Jayawardena said, rolling his window back up and clipping one of the badges onto his shirt pocket. The guard opened the gate and motioned them past with his red-tipped flashlight. Jayawardena sighed as they drove through and the gate closed behind them. He directed Saul to the officer's complex and patted the driver on the shoulder.
"You know what to do."
Saul eased the car to a stop between two faded yellow stripes and removed the keys, holding them between his thumb and forefinger.
"As long as the trunk opens, you don't have to worry about my screwing up."
They got out of the car and walked down the sidewalk toward the building. Jayawardena heard helicopter rotors cutting the air overhead. Once inside, Tachyon stayed at Jayawardena's side as he guided them down the linoleum hallways. The alien was fussing with the cuffs of his coral-pink shirt. Paula and Danforth followed closely behind them, whispering to each other. The corporal in the general's outer office looked up from his cup of tea and waved them in. The general was sitting behind his desk in a large swivel chair. He was a man of average height and compact build with dark, deep-set eyes and an expression that seldom changed. Some in the military community felt that at 54, Dissanayake was too young to be a general. but he had been both firm and controlled in his dealing with the Tamil Tigers, a militant separatist group. He had managed to avoid a bloodbath without appearing weak. Jai Warden respected him. The general nodded as they entered, pointing to the group of chairs opposite his cluttered desk.
"Please, sit down," Dissanayake said, tightening his lips into a half-smile. His English was not as good as Jai Wardner's, but was still easily understandable.
"And always a pleasure to see you, Mr. Jai Wardner. And, of course, to welcome our other distinguished visitors."
"Thank you, General." Jai Wardner waited for the others to seat themselves before continuing. "We know that you're quite busy now, and appreciate your time."
Dissanayake looked at his gold watch and nodded.
"Yes, I'm supposed to be up at operations right now. The first wave is scheduled to be taking off as we speak, so," he said, clasping his hands, "if you could be as brief as possible."
"We don't think you should attack the ape," Tachyon said. "To my knowledge, it's never harmed anyone. Are there any reports of casualties so far?"
"None have been reported, Doctor," Dissanayake leaned back in his chair. "But the monster is headed for Adam's Peak. If unchecked, there will almost certainly be fatalities."
"But what about Robin?" Paula said. "You go after the ape with attack choppers and she's likely to be killed."
"And if we do nothing, hundreds could be killed. Possibly thousands if it reaches the city."
Dissanayake bit his lip.
"It is my duty to prevent that from happening.
I do understand what it means to have a friend in danger.
And be assured, we will do everything possible to rescue Miss Sims. My men will sacrifice their own lives to save hers if need be. But to me, her safety is no more important than the others who are threatened.
Please, try to understand my position."
"And nothing we can say will persuade you even to postpone the attack?"
Tachyon hand-combed his hair back out of his eyes.
"The ape is very near to Adam's Peak. There are many pilgrims at this time of year, and there's no time for a successful evacuation. Delay will almost certainly cost lives."
Dissanayake stood and picked up his cap from the desktop.
"And now I must see to my duties. You're welcome to monitor the operation from here if you like."
Jai Wardener shook his head. "No, thank you. We do appreciate your taking time to see us."
The general extended his palms.
"I wish I could have been more helpful. Good luck to us all. Even the ape."
The sky was beginning to brighten when they got back to the car. Saul was leaning against the door, an unlit cigarette in his mouth. Tachyon and Jai Wardener walked over to him as Danforth and Paula got into the car.
"Everything proceeding according to plan?" Jai Wardener asked.
"She's out and hidden. Nobody seems to have noticed a thing." Saul pulled out a plastic lighter.
"Now?"
"Now or never," said Tachyon, sliding into the back seat.
Saul flicked the lighter and stared a moment at the flame before starting up a cigarette.
"Let's get the hell out of Dodge."
5 minutes, said Jai Wardener, walking quickly to the other side of the car.
They pulled up next to the front gate. The guard walked slowly over and extended his hand.
"Your badges, please."
Jai Wardener unclipped his and handed it over as the guard collected them.
"Shit," said Danforth. "I dropped the damn thing."
Saul flipped on the car's interior lights. Jai Wardener glanced at his watch. They didn't have time for this. Danforth reached into the crack between the edge of the seat and the door, made a face, and pulled out the badge. He handed it quickly to the guard, who took the badges back to his post before swinging the gate open. The gate creaked closed behind them with less than 2 minutes left. Saul pushed the accelerator quickly up to 50, doing his best to avoid the larger potholes.
"I hope Radha can manage this. She's never extended her powers over such a large area before."
Tachyon drummed his fingers on the vinyl car seat. He turned to look back. "We're far enough away, I think. Stop here." Saul pulled over and they all got out and looked back toward the base.
"I don't get it," Danforth crouched down next to the rear of the car. "I mean, all she can do is turn into an elephant. I don't see where this gets us."
"Yes, but the mass has to come from somewhere, Mr. Danforth. And the electrical energy is the most easily convertible source."
Tachyon looked at his watch. 20 seconds.
"You know, if you could make your movies this exciting, Mr. D," Paula shook her head. "Come on, Radha."
The entire base went silently dark.
"Hot damn." Danforth popped up and bounced on his toes. "She did it."
Jai Wardner looked at the gray sky above the horizon. A dark shape lifted itself up out of the larger blackness and moved toward them, throwing off occasional blue sparks.
"I think she may be a bit overcharged," said Tachyon. "But no gunfire. I'm sure they don't know what hit them."
"That's fine," said Danforth.
because I'm not really sure what did either. What I understand, said Saul, leaning into the front seat and starting up the car, is that no more choppers are taken off from there for a while, and Miss Elephant Girl owes me a new battery from yesterday. Ratha flew in and landed next to the car, sparks igniting from each foot as she touched the ground. Jaiwadna thought she looked a little bigger than she had the day before. Tachyon walked over and stepped onto her front leg, his hair standing out like a clown's wig as he touched her. Ratha lifted him up onto her back. We'll see you soon, with luck, the alien said, waving. Jaiwadna nodded. The drive to Advent's Peak should take us about an hour from here. Fly northwest as quickly as you can. The elephant rose noiselessly into the air, and they were gone before anything else could be said. The road was narrow. Dense trees grew to its edge and stretched ahead endlessly. They had been alone except for a bus and a few horse-drawn carts. Jaiwadna explained to them what the ape really was and how he had come by the knowledge. Discussing his ace ability past the time during the drive, Saul was pushing as hard as he could on the mud-slicked roads, making better time than Jaiwadna had thought possible.
I don't understand one thing, though, said Paula, leaning forward from the back seat to put her head next to his. If these visions are always true, why are you working so hard to see that things turn out?
For myself, there's no choice, Jaiwadna said. I cannot let the visions dictate how I lead my life. So I try to act as I would have without such knowledge. And a little knowledge of the future is very dangerous.
The final outcome is not my only concern. What happens in the interim is equally as important. If anyone was killed by the ape because I knew it would ultimately have its humanity restored, I would be guilty of having caused that death.
I think you're being a little hard on yourself, Paula gave his shoulder a light squeeze. There's only so much anyone can do.
Those are my beliefs.
Jaiwadna turned around and looked into her eyes. She returned the look for an instant, then sank back next to Danforth.
Something going on up ahead, Saul said in a level, almost disinterested tone.
They were at the top of a hill. The trees had been cleared away from the roadside for 100 yards or so on either side, giving them an unobstructed view. Sripatha's peak was still shrouded in the early morning mist. Helicopters circled something unseen near the base of the mountain.
Think it's our boy they're after? Asked Danforth.
Almost certainly, Jaiwadna wished he had brought along field glasses.
One of the circling shapes might be Ratha and Tachyon, but from this distance there was no way to tell. The clearing ended and they were again surrounded by jungle.
Want me to jack it up a little? Saul crushed out his cigarette in the ashtray.
As long as we get there alive, Paula said, fastening her seatbelt.
Saul pushed the accelerator down a little farther, leaving a spray of mud behind them. They parked behind a pair of abandoned buses that blocked off the road. No one was visible other than the beast and its attackers. The pilgrims had either fled up the mountain or back down the road into the valley. Jaiwadna walked as quickly as he could up the stone steps, the others following behind him. The helicopters had kept the ape from making it very far up the mountain.
Any sign of our elephant? Asked Danforth.
Can't see them from here.
Jaiwadna's sides already hurt from the exertion. He paused to rest a moment and looked up as one of the choppers dropped a steel net. There was an answering roar, but they couldn't tell if the net had found its target. They worked their way up the steps for several 100 yards, passing through an empty but undamaged rest station. The helicopters were still pressing their attack, although they appeared to be fewer in number now. Jaiwadna slipped on one of the wet flagstones and smashed his knee against a step edge. Saul grabbed him by the armpits and lifted him up.
I'm all right, he said, painfully straightening his leg. Let's keep on.
An elephant trumpeted in the distance.
Hurry, said Paula, taking the stairs in twos.
Jaiwadna and the others trotted up after her. After another 100-yard climb, he stopped them.
We have to cut across the mountain's face here. The footing is very dangerous. Hold on to the trees when you can.
He stepped out onto the moist soil and steadied himself against a coconut palm, then began working slowly toward the direction of the battle. They were slightly higher than the ape when they got close enough to see what was going on. The monster had a steel net in one hand and a stripped tree in the other. It was holding Ratha and the two remaining helicopters at bay like a gladiator with a net and trident. Jaiwadna couldn't see Robin, but assumed that the beast had her in the top of a tree again.
Well, now that we're here, what the hell do we do?
Danforth leaned against a jack tree, breathing hard.
We go get Robin. Paula wiped her muddy hands on her shorts and took a step toward the ape.
Wait, Danforth grabbed her hand.
I can't afford to lose you, too. Let's see what Tachyon can do.
No, Paula said, twisting away. We have to get her out while the ape's distracted.
The pair stared hard at each other for a moment. Then Jaiwaldana came between them.
Let's get a bit closer and see what's possible.
They half-slid, half-walked down the slope, then hit a ledge that was deep mud. Jaiwaldana felt it slip uncomfortably into his shoes. Robin was still nowhere in sight, but the ape hadn't noticed them.
The last helicopter moved into position over the ape and dropped its net. The ape caught it on the end of the tree and deflected it to one side, then tossed the tree at the retreating chopper, which had to bank away sharply to avoid being hit. The ape beat its chest and roared.
Radha and Tachyon moved in from behind a treetop level. The ape reached down, picked up one of the steel nets, and swung it in a blur of motion. There was a pinging thwack as the edge of the net caught Radha on the foreleg. Tachyon slipped off her back and was left dangling from her ear. Radha gained height and pulled Tachyon back up onto her shoulders. The ape pounded the earth and bared its teeth, then stood there, clutching and unclutching its huge black hands.
I don't see what they can do, said Danforth. That thing is just too strong.
We shall see, Jaiwaldana said.
Tachyon leaned in close to one of Radha's immense ears. The elephant dropped down like a stone for a distance, then began circling rapidly around the ape's head. The ape lifted its arms and twisted around, trying to keep its enemy in sight. After a few moments, the creature was half a turn behind the elephant. Radha dove directly for the ape's back. Tachyon jumped onto the ape's neck, and the flying elephant moved away quickly to a safe distance. The ape hunched down, then reached back for Tachyon, who was clinging to the thick fur on its shoulder. The beast plucked the alien off easily and held him up for inspection, then roared and brought Tachyon toward its mouth.
Holy shit, said Danforth, restraining Paula.
The monster had Tachyon almost into its mouth when it froze, jerked convulsively for a moment, and toppled over backward. The impact jarred water from the trees, streaking the mud on the faces of Jaiwaldana and his companions. Jaiwaldana hurried downhill toward the ape, trying to ignore the pain in his knee. Tachyon was squirming out of the ape's rigid fingers when they arrived at the creature's side. He slid down quickly off the giant body and steadied himself against Jaiwaldana.
Burning sky, you were right, Mr. Jaiwaldana. He took several deep breaths. There is a man inside the beast.
How did you stop it? Danforth asked, staying a few steps farther away than the others. And where's Robin?
Headed back to North Dakota,
came a weak voice from a nearby treetop. Robin waved and began picking her way down.
I'll see if she's okay, Paula said, running over.
To answer your first question, Mr. Danforth, Tachyon said, counting the missing buttons on his shirt, the main portion of the brain is simian and consists mostly of an old black and white film. But there is also a human personality, completely subordinate to the ape mentality. I have temporarily given them equal control, thus providing a stasis that has paralyzed it.
Danforth nodded uncomprehendingly. So, what do we do now?
Dr. Tachyon will now restore the ape to human form.
Jaiwaldana rubbed his leg.
The military isn't likely to stay away for long. There isn't much time to do what must be done.
As if to punctuate his remark, one of the helicopters appeared and hovered over them for a moment before turning away. Tachyon nodded and looked at Jaiwaldana.
You saw the transformation in your vision. Was I injured, just out of curiosity?
Jaiwaldana shrugged. Would it matter?
No, I suppose not.
Tachyon chewed on a fingernail.
Matter. That's the real problem. When we restore the human mind to dominance, he'll shed all that excess matter as energy. Anyone near, including myself, is likely to be killed.
Jaiwaldana pointed to Radha, who was helping Robin down out of the tree.
Perhaps if you were held in the air, ungrounded, so to speak, the danger would be minimized. And if the energy was channeled into something like a lightning bolt.
Jaiwaldana looked up at the overcast sky.
Yes, that idea has possibilities.
Tachyon nodded and yelled to Radha,
don't change back yet.
A few minutes later, everyone was in position. Jaiwaldana sat next to Paula, who held Robin's head in her lap. Saul and Danforth stood a few yards away. Radha, some 10 feet off the ground, held Tachyon in her trunk a few feet from the ape's head. Saul had torn his shirt into blindfolds for Elephant Girl and Tachyon. They could hear the beast's labored breathing from where they sat.
"You'd better close your eyes or turn away," said Jayawardena.
They did as he suggested.
The vision took over, and Jayawardena felt all the air go out of him. He smelled the damp jungle, heard birds singing and the faraway flap of helicopter rotors.
The sun went behind a cloud.
An ant crawled up his leg.
He shut his eyes.
Even through his closed lids, the flash was magnesium bright. There was a single deafening boom of thunder.
He jumped involuntarily, then waited a moment and opened his eyes.
Through the white streak in his vision caused by the flash, he saw Tachyon kneeling next to a thin, naked Caucasian man. Radha was stomping out small fires that had broken out in a circle around them.
"How am I going to explain this to the Central Park Zoo?" asked Danforth, his expression dazed.
"Oh, I don't know," said Jayawardena, moving slowly back down the mountainside toward Tachyon.
"It sounds like great pub to me."
Tachyon helped the naked man to his feet. He was of average height, with plain features. He moved his mouth, but made no sound.
"I think he's come through it intact," said Tachyon, getting his shoulder under the man's armpit. "Thanks to you."
Jayawardena shook his head and pulled three identical envelopes out of his pants pocket.
"What happened had to happen. When the military shows up, and they will, I want you to deliver these to them. Say they are from me. One goes to the president, one the minister of state, the last to the minister of the interior. It is my letter of resignation."
Tachyon took the envelopes and tucked them away.
"I see.
As for me, I intend to make the pilgrimage to the top of Sripada. Perhaps it will help me achieve my goal, to be rid of these visions."
Jayawardena headed back toward the stone steps.
"Mr. Jayawardena," Tachyon said, "if your pilgrimage is not successful, I would be willing to do anything possible to help you. Perhaps try to put some mental damper to keep you out of touch with your ability. We leave tomorrow. I suspect your government will be glad to see us go, but you'd be more than welcome to come with us."
Jayawardena bowed and moved over toward Paula and Robin.
"Mr. Jayawardena,"
Robin said in a rasping voice. Her blonde hair was tangled and matted with mud. Her clothes were in shreds. Jayawardena tried not to look.
"Thank you for helping save me."
"You're most welcome, but you should be gotten to a hospital as soon as possible, just for observation."
He turned to Paula.
"I plan to make the pilgrimage up the mountain now, if you'd like to come."
"I don't know," said Paula, looking down at Robin. "Go ahead," Robin said. "I'll be fine."
Paula smiled and looked back at Jayawardena.
"I'd love to."
The multicolored neon reflects brokenly from the wet pavement. The Japanese are all around us, mostly men. They stare at Peregrine, who has her beautiful, banded wings folded tight around her. She looks ahead, ignoring them. "We have been walking a long way. My sides burn and my feet ache." She stops at an alleyway and turns to me. I nod. She walks slowly into the darkness. I follow, afraid of making a noise that will attract attention. I feel useless, like a shadow. Peregrine stretches her wings. They almost touch the cold stone on either side of the alleyway. She folds them back. A door opens, and the alley is filled with light. A man steps out. He's thin, tall, with dark skin, almond eyes, and a high forehead. He cranes his head forward to look at us. "Fortunato?" she asks.
Jayawardena crouched next to the dying embers of the campfire. A few other pilgrims sat wordlessly next to him. The vision had awakened him. Even here there was no escape. Although the pilgrimage was not officially complete until he returned home, he knew that the visions would continue. He was tainted with the wild card virus, perhaps tainted by the years it spent in foreign countries. Spiritual purity and completeness was impossible to attain, at least for the present. Paula came up behind him and put her hands lightly on his shoulders.
"It's beautiful up here, really."
The others around the campfire looked up at her suspiciously. Jayawardena guided her away. They stood at the edge of the peak, staring out into the dark mist down the mountain.
Each religion has its own belief about the footprint, he said. We believe it was made by Buddha.
The Hindus say it was made by Shiva. Muslims argue that it is where Adam stood for 1,000 years, atoning for the loss of paradise.
Whoever it was, they had a big foot, Paula said. That print was 3 feet long.
The sun came up over the horizon, slowly bringing light to the swirling mist below them. Their shadows grew huge in the grayness.
Jayawardena caught his breath. The specter of the Brocken, he said, closing his eyes in prayer.
Wow, said Paula. I guess it's my week for things giant.
Jayawardena opened his eyes and sighed. His fantasies about Paula had been as unrealistic as those about his hope of destroying his power through the pilgrimage. They were like 2 wheels in a clockwork whose teeth meshed, but whose centers forever remained at a distance.
What you have seen is the rarest of wonders here. One can come here every day for a year and not witness what we have.
Paula yawned, then smiled weakly.
Sounds like it's time to go down.
Yes. It's time.
Danforth and Paula met him at the airport. Danforth was shaved and in clean clothes, almost the same cocksure producer he had met only a few days ago. Paula wore shorts and a tight white t-shirt. She seemed ready to get on with her life. Jayawardena envied her.
How's Miss Sims? He asked.
Danforth rolled his eyes. Well enough to have called her lawyer 3 times in the last 12 hours. I'm really in the soup now. I'll be lucky to stay in the business at all.
Offer her a 5-pitcher deal and plenty of points, said
Jayawardena, cramming his entire knowledge of film jargon into one sentence.
Sign this guy up, Mr. D.
Paula grinned and took Jayawardena by the arm.
He might be able to get you out of some jams even I couldn't.
Danforth stuck his thumbs through his belt loops and rocked back and forth. That's really not a bad idea.
Not bad at all.
He took Jayawardena's hand and shook it.
I really don't know what we would have done without you.
Gone right down the drain.
Paula gave Jayawardena a one-shoulder hug.
I guess this is where we have to say goodbye.
Mr. Jayawardena?
A young government courier shouldered his way through the crowd to their side. He was breathing hard, but took time to straighten his uniform before handing Jayawardena an envelope. It bore the presidential seal.
Thank you, he said, popping it open with his thumb.
He read it silently. Paula leaned in to look, but the writing was Sinhalese.
What does it say?
That my resignation has not been accepted, and I am considered to be on an extended leave of absence.
Not exactly the safest thing you could have done, but much appreciated.
He bowed to Danforth and Paula. I'll look for the film when it comes out.
King Pongo, Danforth said. It'll be a monster hit, for sure.
The plane was more crowded than he had expected. People had been wandering around since after takeoff, chatting, complaining, getting drunk. Peregrine was standing in the aisle, talking to the tall blonde man who'd been with her in the bar. They were keeping their voices low, but Jayawardena could tell from the looks on their faces that it was not a pleasant conversation. Peregrine turned away from the man, took a deep breath, and walked over to Jayawardena.
May I sit next to you? She asked. I know everyone else on this plane, some considerably better than I like.
I'm flattered and delighted, he said,
and it was true. Her features and fragrance were beautiful but intimidating, even to him. She smiled, her lips curving in an almost inhumanly attractive manner.
That man you and Tack saved, he's sitting right over there.
She indicated him with the arch of an eyebrow.
His name's Jeremiah Strauss. Used to be a minor league ace named the Projectionist. I guess we're all bozos on this bus. Ah, here he comes now.
Strauss wandered over, his hands clutching the backs of seats as he went. He was pale and afraid.
Mr. Jayawardena,
he said as if he'd been practicing the pronunciation for the last 10 minutes.
My name is Strauss. I've been told all that you did for me, and I want you to know that I never forget a favor. If you need a job when we get to New York, Uthant's a friend of the family. We'll work something out.
That's very kind of you, Mr. Strauss, but
I would have done it in any case. Jaiwardena reached up and shook his hand. Strauss smiled, straightened his shoulders, and clutched his way back to his seat. I'd say he's gonna need quite a while to readjust, Peregrine said in a whisper. 20+ years is a lot to lose. I can only wish him a speedy recovery. It's difficult to feel sorry for myself considering his circumstances. Feeling sorry for oneself is an inalienable right, she yawned. I can't believe how much I'm sleeping. Should have time for a nice long nap before we get to Thailand. Do you mind if I use your shoulder?
No, please think of it as your own.
He looked out the window.
Australia. Then where?
She rested her head against him and closed her eyes. Malaysia, Vietnam, Indonesia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, China, Japan. Fortunato. She said the last word almost too quietly for him to hear. I doubt we'll be running into him.
But you will.
He said it, hoping to please her, but she looked at him as if she'd caught him going through her underwear.
You know this.
You've had one of those visions about me. Someone had obviously told her about his power.
Yes. I'm sorry, I really have no control over them.
He looked back out the window, feeling ashamed. She rested her head back onto his shoulder.
It's not your fault.
Don't worry. I'm sure Tack will be able to do something for you.
I hope so.
She'd been asleep for over an hour. He'd eaten one-handed to keep from waking her up. The roast beef he'd had was like a ball of lead in his stomach. He knew he would survive Western food at least until they reached Japan. The air was a low rumble as it rushed by the plane's metal skin. Peregrine breathed softly next to his ear. Jaiwardena closed his eyes and prayed for dreamless sleep.
Down in the Dreamtime by Edward Bryant. Read for you by Casey Lansdale. Cordelia Chazen had dreamed about the murder less frequently during the month past. It surprised her she still thought of it even that much. After all, she had seen far worse. Work consumed her. The job with Global Fun and Games sufficiently exhausted her days. Laboring on the AIDS WCV benefit to be held in May at Xavier Desmond's Jokertown Funhouse took up much of the nights. Most evenings, she went to sleep long after the 11 o'clock news. 5 in the morning came all too early. There was little time for diversion. But there were still the occasional bad nights of dreaming. Coming up out of the 14th Street station, heels clicking smartly on the dirty concrete, traffic muttering down from above, hearing the voice a few steps up at street level saying, "Just give us the purse, bitch!" Hesitating, then going ahead anyway. Fearing, but... She heard the second voice, the Aussie accent. "Good day, mates. Some problem yet?" Cordelia emerged from the stairwell into the sweltering night. She saw the instant tableau of two unshaven white punks backing a middle-aged woman into the space between the short row of phone carrels and the plywood butt of a shuttered newsstand. The woman had tight hold of both a yapping black poodle and her handbag. Sunburnt and rangy, the man Cordelia assumed was an Aussie faced down the two youths. He wore a sand-colored outfit that looked like a rougher, more authentic version of a Banana Republic ensemble. There was a bright, well-cared-for knife in one hand. "A problem, sonny," he repeated. "No, no problem, dickhead," said one of the punks. He pulled out a short-barreled pistol from his jacket and shot the Aussie in the face. It simply happened too quickly for Cordelia to react. As the man fell to the sidewalk, the assailants ran. The woman with the poodle screamed, momentarily harmonizing with the cries of the dog. Cordelia ran to the man and knelt beside him. She felt for the pulse in his neck, almost imperceptible. It was probably too late for CPR. She averted her gaze from the blood pooling beneath the man's head. The hot, metallic smell of blood nauseated her. A siren wailed up the scales less than a block away. "I've still got my purse," the woman cried. The man's face twitched. He died. "Shit," said Cordelia softly, helplessly. There wasn't a damn thing she could do. Some kind of trouble now, Cordelia thought, as a dark-suited man she didn't recognize waved her into one of GF&G's executive offices. Deep shit, maybe. The two women standing by the desk examined a stack of printouts. Red-haired and tough, Polly Reddick was marketing chief for the GF&G satellite service. She was Cordelia's immediate boss. The other woman was Luz Alcala, vice president for programming and Reddick's boss. Neither Reddick nor Alcala smiled as they usually did. The man in black stepped back by the door and stood there with his arms folded. Security? Cordelia speculated.
Good morning, Cordelia, Reddick said. Please, have a seat. We'll be with you in just a moment.
She turned her attention back to Alcala and pointed out something on the sheet in her hand. Luz Alcala slowly nodded.
Either we buy it first or we're dead in the water. Maybe hire someone good.
Don't even think it, said Reddick, frowning slightly.
It might become necessary, Alcala said. He's dangerous.
Cordelia tried to keep the bewildered look off her face.
He's also too powerful.
Folding her hands, Reddick turned toward Cordelia.
Tell me what you know about Australia.
I've seen everything Peter Weir ever directed, Cordelia said, momentarily hesitating.
What was going on here?
You've never been there? New York is the farthest I've ever been from home.
Home was Atelier Parish, Louisiana. Home was a place she'd rather not think about. In most respects, it didn't exist.
Reddick was looking at Alcala.
What do you think?
I think, Jess.
The older woman picked up a thick envelope and handed it across the desk to Cordelia.
Open it, please.
She found a passport, a sheaf of airline tickets, an American Express card, and a hefty folder of traveler's checks.
You'll need to sign those, Alcala indicated the checks and the credit card.
Cordelia looked silently up from the smiling image affixed to the first page of the passport.
Nice photo, she said. I don't remember applying.
There was little time, said Polly Reddick apologetically. We took liberties.
The point is, said Alcala, you're leaving this afternoon for the other side of the world.
Cordelia felt stunned, then recognized the excitement growing.
All the way to Australia?
Commercial flight, said Alcala.
Brief stops for fuel in L.A., Honolulu, and Auckland.
In Sydney, you'll catch an Ansett flight to Melbourne and another plane up to Alice Springs. Then you'll rent a Land Rover and drive to Marigap.
You're going to have a full day, she added dryly.
A thousand things crowded into Cordelia's mind.
But what about my job here? And I can't just abandon the benefit. I want to go to New Jersey this weekend to check out Buddy Holly.
He can wait till you're back. The whole benefit can wait, said Reddick firmly.
PR is fine, but the JADL and the Manhattan AIDS Project don't pay your salary. This is global fun and games business.
But it is important.
Voice smoothly modulated, Alcala made it sound like a pronouncement.
But what is it?
She felt as if she were listening to Auntie Alice on Radio Wonderland.
What's all this about?
Alcala seemed to be picking her words carefully.
You've seen the PR flacking GF&G's plan to inaugurate a worldwide entertainment service via satellite.
Cordelia nodded. I thought that was years down the road.
It was. The only thing holding back the plan was the investment capital.
We've got the money, Reddick said. We have the help of allied investors. Now we need the satellite time and the ground stations to pipe our programming down to the Earth.
Unfortunately, said Alcala, we have sudden competition for securing the services of the commercial facility in the telecommunications complex in Marigap, a man named Leo Barnett.
The TV evangelist?
Alcala nodded.
The ace-baiting, intolerant, psychotic, species chauvinist son of a bitch, said Reddick with sudden passion. That TV evangelist. Fire breather, some call him.
And you're sending me to Marigap? Said Cordelia excitedly.
Incredible, she thought. It was too good to be true.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll do a terrific job.
Redick and Alcala glanced at each other. "Hold on," said Alcala. "You're going along to assist, but you're not going to be negotiating." It was too good to be true. Shit, she thought. "Meet Mr. Carlucci," said Alcala. "Mari," said a nasal voice from behind Cordelia. "Mr. Carlucci," Alcala repeated. Cordelia turned and took another, closer look at the man she had dismissed as some kind of hired help. Medium height, compact build, styled black hair. Carlucci smiled. He looked like a thug. An amiable one, but still a thug. His suit didn't look as if it had come off the rack. Now that she looked more closely, the coat looked expensively tailored to a T. Carlucci extended his hand. "It's Marty," he said. "We gotta spend a day and a night on a plane. We might as well be friendly about it, you know?" Cordelia sensed disapproval from the two older women. She took Carlucci's hand. She was no jock, but she knew she had a firm grip. Cordelia felt that the man could have squeezed her fingers a lot harder had he wished to. Behind his smile, she sensed a glint of something feral. Not a man to cross. "Mr. Carlucci," said Alcala, "represents a large investors group that has entered into partnership with us in the matter of acquiring a major share in Global Satellite Entertainment. They are providing a portion of the capital with which we expect to set up the initial satellite net." "A lot of bucks," said Carlucci. "But we'll all make it back, and probably 10 times as much in about 5 years. With our resources and your ability to," he grinned, "acquire talent, I figure there's no way we can lose. Everybody makes out." "But we do wish to saturate the Australian market," said Alcala, "and the ground station is already in place. All we need is a signed letter of intent to sell. I can be very persuasive." Carlucci grinned again. To Cordelia, the expression looked like a barracuda showing its teeth, or maybe a wolf. Something predatory, and definitely persuasive. "You better go pack, dear," said Alcala. "Try for 1 carry-on bag, enough clothes to last a week. 1 sophisticated outfit, a more comfortable one for the outback. Anything else you need, you can buy there. Alice Springs is isolated, but it is not an uncivilized place." "It ain't Brooklyn," said Carlucci. "No," said Alcala. "No, it isn't." "Be at Tomlin," said Redick, "by 4. Cordelia glanced from Carlucci to Redick to Alcala. "I meant it before. Thank you. I'll do a good job." "I know you will, dear," said Alcala, her dark eyes suddenly looking tired. "I hope so," Redick said. Cordelia knew she was dismissed. She turned and headed for the door. "See you on the plane," said Carlucci. "First class all the way. Hope you don't mind smoking." She hesitated only momentarily, then said firmly, "I do." For the first time, Carlucci frowned. Polly Redick grinned. Even Lou Sakala smiled. Cordelia lived in an apartment with a single roommate in a high-rise on Maiden Lane near the Woolworth Building and Jet Boy's tomb. Veronica wasn't home, so Cordelia scrawled a brief note. It took her about 10 minutes to pack what she thought she'd need on the trip. Then she called Uncle Jack and asked whether he could meet her before she hopped the Tomlin Express. He could. It was one of his days off. Jack Robichaux was waiting for her in the diner when she entered from the avenue. No surprise. He knew the transit system below Manhattan better than anyone else. Every time Cordelia saw her uncle, she felt as if she were looking into a mirror. True, he was male, 25 years older, 60 pounds heavier. But the dark hair and eyes were the same. So were the cheekbones. The family resemblance was undeniable. And then there was the less tangible similarity. Both had despaired of any kind of normal growing up in Louisiana. Each in young adulthood had fled Cajun country and run away to New York City. "Hey, Cody!" Jack rose to his feet when he saw her, gave her a firm hug and a kiss on the cheek. "I'm going to Australia, Uncle Jack." She hadn't meant to give away the surprise, but it burst out anyway. "No kidding," Jack grinned. "When?" "Today." "Yeah? Jack sat down and leaned back in the green Naga hide seat.
How come?
She told him about the meeting. Jack frowned at the mention of Carlucci.
You know what I think? Suzanne, vagabond, has been hanging around Rosemary in the DA's office, feeding me a little spare time work. I don't hear everything, but I catch enough. I think maybe we're talking about Gambioni cash here.
GF&G wouldn't go for that, said Cordelia. They're legitimate, even if they do funnel money from the skin mags.
Desperation breeds a special blindness, especially if the money's been laundered through Havana. I know Rosemary's been trying to steer the Gambionis into legitimate enterprise. I guess satellite TV qualifies.
That's my job you're talking about, said Cordelia. Better than hooking for the big F. Cordelia knew her cheeks were coloring. Jack looked repentant.
Sorry, he said. I wasn't trying to be bitchy.
Listen, this was really a big day for me. I just wanted to share it.
I appreciate that.
Jack leaned across the Formica table. I know you're gonna do just fine down under, but if you need any help, if you need anything at all, just call.
Halfway around the world?
He nodded.
Doesn't matter how far. If I can't be there in person, maybe I can suggest something.
And if you really need a 14-foot gator in the flesh, he grinned, give me about 18 hours. I know you can hold any fort that long.
She knew he meant it. That was why Jack was the only person in the Robichaux clan who meant anything at all to her.
I'll be okay. It's going to be terrific. She got up from the booth.
No coffee?
No time. She hefted the soft leather carry-on case. I need the next train to Tomlin. Please tell Cece goodbye for me. Vagabond and the cats, too.
Jack nodded. Still want the kitten?
You better believe it.
I'll walk you to the station.
Jack got up and took her case. She resisted only a moment before smiling and allowing him.
There's something I want you to remember, said Jack.
Don't talk to strangers, take my pill, eat green vegetables.
Shut up, he said fondly.
Your power and mine, they may be related, but they're still different. I'm not as likely to get turned into a suitcase, said Cordelia. He ignored her. You've used the reptile level in your brain to control some pretty violent situations. You killed folks to protect yourself. Don't forget you can use the power for life, too.
Cordelia felt bewildered.
I don't know how. It scares me. I just would rather ignore it.
But you can't. Remember what I'm saying.
Braving cabs, they crossed the avenue to the subway entrance.
Ever see much Nicholas Rogue? Cordelia said.
Everything, said Jack.
Maybe this will be my walkabout. Just make it back in one piece.
She smiled. If I can deal with a bull alligator here, I figure I can handle a bunch of crocodiles in Australia just fine.
Jack smiled too. It was a warm, friendly expression, but it showed all his teeth.
Jack was a shapeshifter and Cordelia wasn't, but the family resemblance was unmistakable. When she found Marty Carlucci at the United Terminal at Tomlin, Cordelia discovered the man was carrying an expensive alligator overnight bag and a similarly appointed attaché case. She was less than pleased, but there wasn't much she could say. The woman working the computer at the ticketing counter gave them seats one row apart in first class, smoking and non-smoking. Cordelia suspected it wouldn't make much of a difference to her lungs, but felt she had won a moral decision. Also, she suspected she'd feel more comfortable not having to sit with her shoulder rubbing up against his. A good deal of the excitement of travel had worn off by the time the 747 set down at LAX. Cordelia spent much of the next 2 hours looking out at the early evening darkness and wondering if she'd ever get to see the La Brea Tar Pits, Watts Towers, Disneyland, Giant Insect National Monument, the Universal Tour. She bought some paperbacks in the gift shop. Finally, Carlucci and she were called for the Air New Zealand flight. As with the first leg, they had requested first-class seats on either side of the Terminator, dividing active smoke from passive.
Carlucci snored much of the way to Honolulu. Cordelia couldn't sleep at all. She divided her time between the new Jim Thompson mystery and staring out the window at the moonlit Pacific 36,000 feet below. Both Carlucci and she converted some of their traveler's checks into Australian dollars on the concourse in Honolulu. The numbers are good. Carlucci gestured at the conversion chart taped to the window of the change booth. I checked the paper before we left the States. We're still in the States. He ignored her. Just to make conversation, she said, you know a lot about finance? Pride filled his voice. Wharton School of Finance and Commerce. Full ride. Family paid for it. You've got rich parents? He ignored her. The Air New Zealand jumbo loaded and took off, and the stewards fed the passengers one last time in preparation for tucking into the long night to Auckland. Cordelia switched on her reading light when the cabin illumination dimmed. Finally, she heard Carlucci grumble from the row ahead. Get some sleep, kiddo. Jet lag's gonna be bad enough. You got a lot of Pacific to cross yet. Cordelia realized the man had a valid point. She waited a few more minutes so that it would look more like it was her own idea, then switched off the light. She pulled the blanket tight around her and scrunched into the seat so she could look out the port. The travel excitement was almost all gone now. She realized she was indeed exhausted. She saw no clouds, just the shining ocean. She found it astonishing that anything could be so apparently endless, so enigmatic. It occurred to her that the Pacific could swallow up a 747 without more than the tiniest ripple. Ear Moonens. The words meant nothing to her. Ear Moonens. The phrase was so soft it could have been a whisper in her mind. Cordelia's eyes clicked open. Something was very wrong. The reassuring vibration of the jumbo's engines was somehow distorted, blended with the sigh of a rising wind. She tried to throw the suddenly strangling blanket away and clawed her way up the back of the seat ahead, nails biting into the cool leather. When she looked down the other side, Cordelia sharply drew in her breath. She was staring into the wide, surprised, dead eyes of Marty Carlucci. His body still faced forward, but his head had been screwed around 180 degrees. Viscid blood slowly dripped from his ears, his mouth. It had pooled at the bottom of his eyes and was oozing down over his cheekbones. The sound of her scream closed in around Cordelia's head. It was like crying out in a barrel. She finally struggled free of the blanket and stared unbelievingly down the aisle. She still stood in the Air New Zealand 747, and she stood in the desert. One was overlaid on the other. She moved her feet and felt the gritty texture of the sand, heard its rasp. The aisle was dotted with scrubby plants moving as the wind continued to rise. The jumbo's cabin stretched into a distance her eye couldn't quite follow, diminishing endlessly into perspective as it approached the tail section. Cordelia saw no one moving. Uncle Jack! She cried out. There was, of course, no answer. Then she heard the howling. It was a hollow ululation rising and falling, gaining in volume. Far down the cabin, in the tunnel that was also the desert, she saw the shapes leaping toward her. The creatures bounded like wolves, first in the aisle, then scrambling across the tops of the seats. Cordelia smelled a rank, decaying odor. She scrambled into the aisle, recoiling until her spine was flush against the forward bulkhead. The creatures were indistinct in the half-light. She couldn't even be sure of their numbers. They were like wolves, claws clicking and tearing on the seats, but their heads were all wrong. The snouts were blunted off, truncated. Ruffs of shining spines ringed their necks. Their eyes were flat black holes deeper than the surrounding night. Cordelia stared at the teeth. There were just too many long needle fangs to fit comfortably into those mouths. Teeth that champed and clashed, throwing out a spray of dark saliva. The teeth reached for her. Move, goddammit! The voice was in her head. It was her own voice. Move! As teeth and claws sought her throat. Cordelia hurled herself to the side. The lead wolf creature smashed into the steel bulkhead, howled in pain, staggered upright confusedly as the second leaping monster rammed into its ribs. Cordelia scrambled past the confusion of horrors into the narrow galleyway. Focus! Cordelia knew what she had to do. She wasn't Chuck Norris, nor did she have an Uzi in her hand. In her instant of respite as the wolf creatures snarled and spat at one another, she wished again that Jack were here. But he wasn't. Concentrate, she told herself. One of the blunted muzzles poked around the corner of the galley. Cordelia stared into the pair of deadly, matte black eyes. Die, you son of a bitch, she cried aloud. She sensed the power uncoiling from the reptile level of her brain, felt the force flow into the alien mind of the monster, striking directly for the brainstem. She shut off its heart and respiration. The creature struggled toward her, then collapsed forward on its clawed paws. The next monster appeared around the corner. How many of them were there? She tried to think. 6? 8? She wasn't sure. Another blunt muzzle protruded. Another set of claws. More gleaming teeth. Die! She felt the power draining from her. This was no feeling she'd known before. It was like trying to jog in quicksand. The bodies of the wolf creatures piled up. The surviving monsters scrambled over the barrier, lunging at her. The final one made it all the way into the galley. Cordelia tried to shut down its brain, felt the power waning as the creature launched itself down the heaps of corpses. As the toothy jaws reached for her throat, she swung a double fist and tried to smash them aside. One of the spines from the thing's ruff slid into the back of her left hand. Steaming spittle spattered her face. She felt the staccato rhythm of the wolf creature's breathing hesitate and cease as its body slumped onto her feet. But now she felt a chill spreading across her hand and upper arm. Cordelia grasped the spine with her right hand and wrenched it free. The shaft came loose and she hurled it from her, but the coldness didn't abate. It'll reach my heart, she thought, and that was the last thing that passed through her mind. Cordelia felt herself collapsing, falling across the crazy quilt arrangement of monstrous bodies. The wind filled up her ears. The darkness took her eyes. Hey, you okay, kid? What's the matter? The accent was all New York. It was Marty Carlucci's voice. Cordelia struggled to open her eyes. The man bent over her, breath minty with recent toothpaste. He grasped her shoulders and shook her slightly. Irmunens, Cordelia said weakly. Huh? Carlucci looked baffled. You're dead. Damn straight, he said. I don't know how many hours I slept, but I feel like shit. How about you? Memories of the night slammed back. What's going on? Cordelia said. We're landing. Plane's about half an hour out of Auckland. You want to use the can, get cleaned up and all? You better do it quick. He took his fingers away from her shoulders. Okay? Okay. Cordelia sat up shakily. Her head felt as if it were stuffed with sodden cotton. Everybody's okay? The plane isn't full of monsters? Carlucci stared at her. Just tourists. Hey, you have some bad dreams? Want some coffee? Coffee, thanks. She grabbed her bag and struggled past him into the aisle. Right. Nightmares. Bad ones. In the restroom, she alternated splashing cold and hot water on her face. Brushing her teeth helped. She slugged down 3 Midol and unsnarled her hair. Cordelia did her best with makeup. Finally, she stared at herself in the mirror and shook her head. Shit, she told herself. You look 30. Her left hand itched. She raised it in front of her face and stared at the inflamed puncture wound. Maybe she had caught her hand on something when she'd moved in her sleep, and that had translated into the dream. Perhaps it was stigmata. Either story sounded equally implausible. Maybe this was some weird new menstrual side effect. Cordelia shook her head. Nothing made sense. Weakness flooded over her, and she had to sit down on the lid of the toilet. The inside of her skull felt scoured. Maybe she had spent much of the night battling monsters. Cordelia realized someone was knocking on the door of the restroom. Others wanted to get ready for New Zealand, so long as they weren't wolf creatures. The morning was sunny. The North Island of New Zealand was intensely green. The 747 touched down with scarcely a bump and then sat at the end of the runway for 20 minutes until the agriculture people climbed on board. Cordelia hadn't expected that. She watched bemusedly as the smiling young men in their crisp uniforms walked down the aisles, an aerosol jet of pest killer fogging from the can in each hand. Something about this reminded her perversely of what she'd read of the final moments of Jet Boy. Carlucci must have been thinking something similar. Having promised not to smoke, he'd moved into the seat beside her. "Sure hope it's pesticide," he said. "Be a really nasty joke if it was the wild card virus." After the passengers had murmured, griped, wheezed, and coughed, the jumbo taxied to the terminal and everyone debarked. The pilot told them they had 2 hours before the plane left on the 1,000-mile leg to Sydney. "Just time to stretch our legs, buy some cods, make some phone calls," said Carlucci. Cordelia welcomed the thought of getting some exercise. In the main terminal, Carlucci went off to place his trans-Pacific calls. The terminal seemed extraordinarily crowded. Cordelia saw camera crews in the distance. She headed for the doors to the outside. From behind her, she heard, "Cordelia, Miss Chesson." The voice wasn't Carlucci's. Who the hell? She turned and saw a vision of flowing red hair framing a face that looked vaguely like Errol Flynn's in Captain Blood. But Flynn had never worn such bright clothing, not even in the colorized adventures of Captain Fabian. Cordelia stopped and smiled. "So," she said, "do you like new wave music any better these days?" "No," said Dr. Tachyon. "No, I'm afraid I do not." "I fear," said the tall, winged woman standing beside Tachyon, "that our good Tacky will never progress much beyond Tony Bennett." A simply cut, voluminous blue silk dress whispered softly around her. Cordelia blinked. Peregrine was hard to mistake. "Unfair, my dear." Tachyon smiled at his companion. "I have my favorites among contemporary performers. I'm rather fond of Placido Domingo." He turned back toward Cordelia. "I'm forgetting my manners. Cordelia, have you formerly met Peregrine?" Cordelia took the proffered hand. "I've had a call into your agent for weeks now. Nice to see you." "Shut up," she said to herself. "Don't be rude." Peregrine's dazzling blue eyes regarded her. "I'm sorry," she said. "Is this about the benefit at Dez's club? I'm afraid I've been incredibly busy tidying up other projects in the midst of getting ready for this trip." "Peregrine," said Tachyon, "this young woman is Cordelia Chesson. We know each other from the clinic. She's come frequently with friends to visit Cece Ryder." "Cece's going to be able to do the fun house," said Cordelia. "That would be fabulous," said Peregrine. "I've admired her work for a long time." "Perhaps we could all sit down over a drink," said Tachyon. He smiled at Cordelia. "There has been a delay with arranging the senator's ground transport into Auckland. I'm afraid we're stranded at the airport for a bit." The man glanced back over his shoulder. "As well, I'm afraid we are trying to avoid the rest of the party. The aircraft does get a bit close." Cordelia felt the tempting proximity of fresh air starting to drift away. "I've got just about 2 hours," she said, hesitating. "Okay, let's have a drink." As they walked toward the restaurant, Cordelia didn't see Carlucci. He could get along fine by himself. What she did notice was the number of stares following them. No doubt some of the attention was being paid to Tachyon. His hair and wardrobe always ensured that. But mostly people were looking at Peregrine. Probably the New Zealanders weren't all that accustomed to seeing a tall, gorgeous woman with functional wings folded against her back. She was spectacular, Cordelia admitted to herself. It would be great to have the looks, the stature, the presence. At once, Cordelia felt very young, almost like a kid, inadequate. Damn it. Cordelia ordinarily took her coffee with milk, but if Black would help clear her head, then she'd give it a try. She insisted that the three of them wait for a window table. If she wasn't going to breathe the outside air, at least she could sit within inches of it. The colors of the unfamiliar trees reminded her of photos she'd seen of the Monterey Peninsula. So, she said after they'd given orders to the waitress, I guess I should say something about a small world. How's the junket? I saw some pictures of the great ape on the 11 o'clock news before I left. Tachyon rambled on about Senator Hartman's round-the-world tour. Cordelia remembered reading about it interminably in the Post on the subway, but had been so busy with the funhouse benefit, she hadn't paid much attention. Sounds like a backbreaker, she said when Tachyon finished his gloss. Peregrine smiled wanly. It hasn't exactly been a vacation. I think Guatemala is my favorite. Have your people thought of climaxing the benefit with a human sacrifice? Cordelia shook her head. I think we are going for a little more festive tone, even considering the occasion. Listen, Peregrine said. I'll do what I can with my agent. In the meantime, maybe I can introduce you to a few folks who'll do you some good. Do you know Rada O'Reilly? Elephant Girl? At Cordelia's headshake, she continued. When she turns into a flying elephant, it's smoother than anything Doug Hennings dreamed of. You ought to talk to Fantasy, too. You could use a dancer like her. That'd be terrific, Cordelia said. Thank you. She felt the frustration of wanting to do everything herself, showing everyone, and yet knowing when to accept the aid that was being graciously extended. So, Tachyon said, breaking in on her thoughts, and what are you doing here so far from home? His expression looked expectant. His eyes gleamed with honest curiosity. Cordelia knew she couldn't get away with claiming she'd won the trip for selling Girl Scout cookies. She opted for honesty. I'm going to Australia with a guy from GF&G to try and buy a satellite ground station before it gets scoffed up by a TV preacher. Ah, said Tachyon. Would that evangelist be Leo Barnett, by chance? Cordelia nodded. I hope you succeed, Tachyon frowned. Our friend Fire Breather's power is growing at a dangerously exponential rate. I, for one, would prefer to see the growth of his media empire retarded. Just yesterday, said Peregrine, I heard from Chrysalis that some of Barnett's youth group thugs are hanging out in the village and beating the stuffing out of anybody they think is both a joker and vulnerable. Diuden, Tachyon murmured. The two women glanced questioningly at him. History. He sighed, then said to Cordelia, Whatever help you need in competing with Barnett, let us know. I think you'll find a great deal of support from both aces and jokers. Hey, said an overly familiar voice from behind Cordelia's scapula. What's happening? Without looking around, Cordelia said, Marty Carlucci, meet Dr. Tachyon and Peregrine. To the latter, she said, Marty's my chaperone. Hiya. Carlucci took the fourth chair. Yeah, I know you, he said to Tachyon. He stared at Peregrine, frankly surveying her. All of her. You I've seen a lot. I got tapes of every show you've done for years. His eyes narrowed. Say, you pregnant? Thank you, said Peregrine. Yes. She stared him down. Right, said Carlucci. He turned to Cordelia. Kid, come on. We gotta get back on the plane. More firmly. Now. Goodbyes were said. Tachyon volunteered to pay for the coffee. Good luck, Peregrine said, aimed specifically at Cordelia. Carlucci seemed preoccupied, not noticing. As the two of them walked toward the boarding gate, he said, "Dumb fucking bitch." Cordelia stopped dead still. "What?" "Not you." Carlucci took her elbow roughly and propelled her toward the security checkpoint. "That joker who sells info, Chrysalis. I ran into her by the phones. I figured I'd save the price of a call." "So?" said Cordelia. "One of these days, she's going to get her invisible tits caught in the ringer, and there's going to be real bright blood all over the laundry room wall. I told New York that, too." Cordelia waited, but he didn't elaborate. "So?" she said again. "What did you tell those two geeks?" said Carlucci. His voice sounded dangerous. "Nothing," said Cordelia, listening to the internal warning bells. "Nothing at all." "Good." Carlucci grimaced. He mumbled, "She's going to be fish food. I swear it." Cordelia stared at Carlucci. The sheer conviction in his voice kept him from appearing a comic opera gangster. She thought he meant what he was saying. He reminded her of the wolf creatures in last night's maybe dream. All that was missing was the dark spittle.